The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
When we speak of personal histories, we think most often of autobiographies, journals, or even scrapbooks. But what about cultures where there is no written tradition? How do they record their history? And what about videotape or digital recordings? What effect does technology have on our recording of history? Joining me in the Mormon Channel studios today are Mel Thatcher of the Family History Department and Matt Heiss of the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Just so we can get to know both of you better, would you each share with us a brief personal oral history, shall we say, including what brought you to this profession? Mel, let's start with you.
I joined the Family History Department in 1976. The department was recruiting somebody who had background in Asian history or Asian culture. And so I was recruited for that reason. Since joining the department, I've been able to earn my PhD from the University of Washington in history of ancient China. And this historical training and training in non-Western cultures has been very valuable in working with oral cultures of Asia, Pacific, and Africa.
Very good. Matt?
I got hired on at the Historical Department, as we were then called, in January of 1987, right out of grad school. I had done some research on the Salt Lake Temple for my master's thesis at the University of Virginia and thought it would be a wonderful place to work in the church archives if I ever had to drop out of my graduate program. I got the master's degree, started a PhD, ran out of money, and there just happened to be a job in the church archives. So I lucked out. I spent 20 years documenting the international church, specifically in Eastern Europe and Africa. And in Africa in particular, that's where I used a lot of oral history because that was a culture, or those are cultures that don't have a written tradition. And currently I work in a section called Global Development, where we support the area presidencies in the church history work throughout the world.
So just to get us going here, maybe we can have a brief explanation or history of what oral histories are. Either one of you, who would like to tackle that?
Well, I think oral history is recorded conversation. And it might not even need to be recorded. I mean, just what we're doing right now, talking about the oral history program in the church is historical and it's being recorded. It could be a dictation where somebody would just speak into a recording device, or it could be a guided conversation where an interviewer is interviewing a person, capturing a moment in time that may not otherwise be captured in written format.
Now, I say oral history in rather generically, but as I understand, that can mean several different things. Would you help those of us who don't really know the difference between oral histories, genealogies, and traditions? I've just read a couple of these things as I've prepared for this.
In my mind, they would all fall under the umbrella of oral history. And I think the focus or scope of the interview or the dictation would determine what you would want to call it. I mean, I think what Mel has done in Africa in gathering oral genealogy is certainly a part of oral history. My focus mostly has been on events and personalities that have had significant impact on the history of the church in different areas.
I would take a little different perspective in collecting, in the kind of work that I'm involved in. We are collecting oral genealogies. And we are really interested in oral genealogical traditions, meaning information that has been passed down from generation to generation. We are not collecting oral family history, which might be about the experiences of your father, your grandfather growing up, or being engaged in some important political event or a war or whatever. So from my perspective, I would make a distinction between oral history and oral tradition. The former being a person's experience in life and with events, and the latter being passing on information that's been handed down from generation to generation.
So under this umbrella of oral history, let's say it's the history of a certain village. Who in that village is in charge of keeping it? Is it everybody or just an elder, or how does that work?
Well, in an oral culture of the type that where we find oral genealogical traditions, there's usually somebody in the lineage. Lineage being a group that's organized based on descent from a common ancestor. There's somebody in that lineage who is known to carry on the oral genealogical tradition. And those are the people that we look for. We don't just look for any person who belongs to a lineage, but for the one who's the bearer of the tradition.
So maybe each of you can tell me a little about some of the current projects you're working on in these areas.
Yeah, let me tell you a project that we just completed here that was done in Germany. About 2 years ago, Elder Uchtdorf, President Uchtdorf, was thinking about World War II survivors, Latter-day Saint World War II survivors in Germany, Austria, and perhaps some of the other countries around. And he mentioned to Elder Robert Oakes, who at that time was president of the Europe area, that it would be nice if these stories were gathered before they were lost. And so a missionary couple from up north here, they live in West Haven, Utah, Lynn and Faith Hansen, were called to collect these oral histories from church members that had survived World War II. They spent 18 months in Germany and in Austria. I think they went into Switzerland and up to Sweden as well, and recorded over 300 interviews with sometimes these were Latter-day Saints who had experienced the war. Sometimes these were people who had joined the church after the war. They produced this book here, which in German is Der Glaube unserer Vorväter, the faith of our forefathers. And this represents what they collected. They have a photograph of each person they interviewed and then the story that the person told about what it was like to be a Latter-day Saint during World War II, the aftermath of the war, the welfare assistance that the church had sent. But really, the focus of this was on how people struggled to keep their faith in the face of huge, horrific circumstances, losing family members, being driven from their homes. It really started as a project to gather information from people that were refugees living in the East, places that are now Russia, Poland, the Czech Republic. But these were all German settlements and what it was like to have to leave your home and leave everything behind. But then it kind of expanded into this greatest generation of Latter-day Saints. And I say greatest generation kind of going along with what Tom Brokaw did in gathering the stories of the people who experienced World War II here, the Depression and World War II in America, and who built the society that we live in. And in a way, in a sense, these are the greatest generation German Latter-day Saints who built the church society in Germany that that is strong. Their faith was put to the test, and we've got their stories now because of this project. What's interesting is the Hansons told me that two of the people that they interviewed have since passed away, and the Hansons have only been home since July. So those stories may have been unrecorded had they not done this work. So this is a great project.
For our listeners, this big black book sitting here on our desk is like 3 inches thick, and it just must be full of these personal histories.
Yeah.
So I see this book that represents oral history, yet here it is in written form. Where do you actually cross the line? What's the difference?
Well, we've got the audio versions of these, which will eventually be part of the church archives collection, so that the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of these Latter-day Saints will be able to access their voices and the emotion and some of that. We do transcribe some oral histories for the sake of preservation and for easier distribution. A lot of times it's easier to sit down and read through an oral history as opposed to listening to the entire interview. So I don't know that it crosses the line. In my mind, this is still oral history, just
still
in transcribed.
Still the same thing. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. I think of the wax cylinder, having been in the audiovisual department for 20 years, that President Wilford Woodruff recorded bearing his testimony. Of course, there are other AV recordings over the past century that are also very significant. What would you consider some of these recordings oral history?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And is there a place where a normal member of the church can find these type of things?
The Church History Library, across the street from the conference center here, is the place where those are stored and made available to the public. A lot of the oral histories that we record in the Church History Department are not immediately accessible to the public, but some of the more historic ones are. I know the Wilford Woodruff dictation has been recorded, and people can access that. And there are some others that memorable conference talks, other kinds of audiovisual products that are available through the church archives in the family history, in the church history library. Did I say family history library? The church history library.
Okay. Now, there are places that you visited, Mel, probably especially you, that where these villages have the oral tradition. What's going to happen? I mean, if they are not continued, is there a question that they won't be or preserved in a hardbound sort of a fashion?
This definitely is an issue. It's interesting, with the spread of literacy, the economic development, the spread of book learning, education, and all of that, this tends to weaken the oral culture, the oral genealogical, the oral traditions. And so preservation is an issue. It's interesting. In Africa, for example, we did a pilot project in Nigeria, and I went there to visit. This is among the Ibibio people. And the traditional chiefs, the village chief and the paramount chief with the sub-chiefs in the villages, they all felt as though we had actually been, that we'd been sent from God to help preserve their tradition, that was being lost. And so they're very grateful that there's an opportunity to save what is important to them, and to also make sure that it's introduced to later generations. Another interesting experience was in South Africa, where I met a postdoctoral student in anthropology who was working with AIDS orphans. And she expressed a very strong concern that these children who have lost their parents may never be able to connect with their past because they've lost a connection with their ancestors through their parents. And so it's important for many reasons to preserve the oral tradition.
So you are just one man, and there are so many places that need this preservation. what other types of organizations, shall we say, or people that are out there helping to do this?
Well, traditionally, the oral genealogical traditions have been collected by missionaries, Protestant and Catholic missionaries, usually, and also by ethnographers. And, of course, you know, that's also just a few people working and working intensively in a certain place. Widespread collecting of oral genealogical traditions really hasn't been done. So our projects are unique in that sense. We don't just send a foreigner like myself into a village to collect this information, but rather we, whenever possible, we work through local institutions such as a university or some other type of school to organize field workers from the locality to go out and collect this information so that we have more people involved and can move faster. But in reality, we're hardly a drop in the bucket. Our efforts are hardly a drop in the bucket compared to what needs to be done.
That's what it seems. We have, with this German book that you showed us here, Matt, this was compiled by church missionaries. So is this a regular thing that couple missionaries are called to do? Are there lots and lots of missionaries who are doing this? Or
no, we're just starting to pilot this, actually. We like Mel said, we realize the need throughout the church that there are cultures where the church exists that have oral traditions and where they don't have a written tradition, and where writing is really difficult for members of the church. I've been to places in Africa where if I were to say, would you write down your personal history, your conversion experience, it might even be difficult to get pen and paper to do that kind of thing. So we're beginning to experiment with this to decentralize. Back when I was actively collecting, I was kind of like a one-man show, or my fellow workers in the church archives. We'd go out to the countries, we'd select the interviewees, sit down and interview them, bring it all back and process it in the church archives. Now we've got a missionary couple in Ukraine, a missionary couple in West Africa, and some we've piloted it in Central America and Mexico, where we're training the members on how to do this. We're doing it under the direction of the area presidencies, and we're starting to have some pretty good success with it.
Sounds great. In the truest definition of the term, it doesn't seem oral histories are that common in American or Western history. I mean, like the village genealogy or whatever. Is that true here in the West?
I think it's probably more common, depending on how you define oral history. I think, for example, with Thanksgiving coming up, you know, families get together, and what do you do around the table? A lot of times you start sharing stories. I know that when I get together with my brothers and sisters and we talk about Thanksgivings in the past, we kind of talk about our grandparents and some of the unique things that they used to do. And by doing that, we're passing on this tradition to my children and to the next generation. My children knew my grandparents, but not well, and don't have vivid memories the way I do. And so I think that's a way of passing down these traditions in an oral sense. And I've also argued that as I look at what my kids do, they certainly don't do a lot of writing themselves. It's all texting or emails or this or that, and it's very short and abbreviated and grammatically incorrect. And so I think oral history may even be on the rise as we become perhaps a less literate society in terms of writing things down the way that we used to. I mean, when was the last time you actually wrote a letter and put it in an envelope and sent it to somebody, right?
That's true.
It's phone conversation or email or Skype or something like that.
Yep, that makes sense. Can you share some interesting stories associated with oral histories that you've experienced over the past, well, over your professional career?
Wow. I've done like 1,200 different interviews, and so to try to pick out one is sometimes difficult, but I can tell you some that were that were pretty outstanding, where I think doors were open and I was put in situations that were profound. Since we're kind of celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was a year and a half after the wall fell that I went into the former German Democratic Republic, or East Germany. And I had an opportunity to record interviews with three non-Latter-day Saints, but men who had really helped the church that had been in East Germany. One was the former minister of religion who had worked in Erich Honecker's government. One was his assistant that had the specific assignment to work with the LDS Church in East Germany. And one was with the man who was the architect of the Freiburg Temple, a non-Latter-day Saint. And it was interesting that that this man who was the architect of the Freiburg Temple said that because of his association with the West, with the Latter-day Saints, that after this project was done, he had suffered a little bit of persecution. He had had his travel permit revoked and had kind of been shunned because of the work that he did. Luckily, he finished his work in 1985, and 1989 is when the wall fell, so he was able to only experience 4 years of this kind of opposition that he got from the government. But I thought that was interesting. And then when I talked to this man named Günther Benke, who was the worker in the Ministry of Religion assigned to the Latter-day Saint, to our church, he told me some interesting stories about how touched he was personally in his association with the East German Latter-day Saints. And coming out of a society that was kind of negative about religion, it was very interesting to get a sense of what his association with Mormons meant to him on a personal level. He was brought out to General Conference once and was able to do a little bit of touring, and I think that was one of the highlights of his life, to meet President Monson, to see the church here in Salt Lake, and to tour the Grand Canyon.
Wow. Thank you, Matt. We'll give you a break quick. Mel, what about you?
Well, as I mentioned, our oral genealogy interviews are done by local people, not by foreigners such as myself. But I would like to share a couple of some things that I have observed, which help, I think, to understand something about oral cultures and oral traditions. The first thing is that in an oral society, an oral culture, genealogy forms the basic fabric of their society for how they relate to one another. Claims of ownership to property, to trees, or banana trees or whatever, and selection of marriage partners, and many other things. And so just share a few things that I have witnessed. In Sarawak, Malaysia, my most memorable experiences there were going back into the jungles where the Iban people live. They're also known as the Dayak people, where I witnessed a child naming ceremony, where the baby was carried down into the river, and upriver from the baby was a person holding a rooster with a knife, and on the other side of the river was somebody hiding in the bushes representing the ancestors. And so they performed the naming of the baby by slitting the throat of the rooster and the blood coming down the river and dipping the baby in the water and calling out to the ancestors, conversing back and forth. Another instance there was I witnessed this ending of widowhood status, in which a man's wife had died 3 years earlier, and now they brought together three experts in descent, traditional people who know the pedigrees of the people. And they all sat in a circle with the man whose widowhood status was coming to an end, and the three descent specialists then shared stories from the oral genealogy about people of similar status to the person who was now ending his widowhood status to determine what penalties he should pay or what price he must pay to cease being a widow, a widower, I should say. And so after talking, then they decided that he had to pay 20 ringgit, 20 Malaysian dollars, and so many feathers. And then the ceremony ended with him biting the blade of a machete, which now he was free from the status of being a widower. So it's interesting how oral genealogy plays into their community life, the social life and their ritual life, and that's the reason why they have to, I mean, they have kept it and want to perpetuate it if they can. Just one other experience was among the Batak Toba people in Sumatra, where I witnessed, delivery of oral genealogy, and this has to do with how these traditions are transmitted. The average age of informants, no matter where we have collected oral genealogy, seems to be in the mid-50s. Some are a lot older, very few are younger, but typically they're in the late 50s, mid-50s to late 50s. And so here we have, sitting in a traditional house, all of the men of the village sitting in a circle, at least the elders in the village, sitting in a circle with the informant sitting down, and his son, informant about 55, 58 years old, his son sitting next to him, who was about 33 years old, and standing behind the two of them was the grandson, who was about 10 years old. And so as the grandfather talked, the son would chip in and correct him, and other people in the community, they would discuss the differences, and finally they would come up with what they agree on is the correct name or the correct relationship, and then they go on. And so it's interesting there to see how from generation to generation that this tradition is passed on through the recitation in public venues of this information. So I thought that was kind of an eye-opener for me.
Thank you. It seems like it would hold the reciter's feet a little closer to the fire so they get it right, like you mentioned.
Well, I think in an oral culture where genealogy means something, to us it's a hobby. It doesn't determine much in terms of what we do and how we do things. But there, where it's an integral part of their daily life, they have reasons to control it, to keep it accurate. So, for example, if in Sarawak, among the Iban people, if there's a dispute over the ownership of a grove of trees, then they again bring together three descent specialists, and they have the two parties who are claiming the same grove of trees then give their genealogical claim to that grove of trees. And the three genealogical specialists then decide which one has made the accurate claim.
Judge, okay.
So there are reasons why they have to have control.
Matt.
I wanted to include a story that I recorded in East Berlin. I didn't want to give the impression that I just went in and interviewed, former communist officials and non-Latter-day Saints. When I was in East Berlin, I had an opportunity to interview a man who was serving as a bishop. And he told me an interesting story that because his wife worked in some of the embassies in East Berlin, he and his wife feared that their apartment had been bugged. And so anytime they wanted to have a private conversation, they either had to leave their apartment and go walking, or they would go into their very small bathroom and turn on the bathtub so the water would be running, and then they could whisper to each other because they didn't want the government listeners, the secret police, to get in on their conversations. But I think that's kind of a reflection of what the East German Latter-day Saints lived under for those 40 years, behind the wall and in their own country. So that's just another story I thought I'd throw in.
Thank you. You've talked briefly about the actual sound of a voice and the inflection and whatever else that we gain from an oral history versus other types. What other things do you think we gain?
I think we gained the opportunity to analyze more deeply than we would if we just had a written record. And in anticipation of that very question, I brought something that I've used in presentations before. It's a page from Brigham Young's journal, which I have here on this piece of paper. Here's the actual journal page, and here it is typed up. And let me just read a couple of lines from that journal and talk about what I would like to do as an oral historian if I could go back to the 12th of September, 1845. Brigham starts his journal by saying, "This morning, another message arrives stating that five houses more had burned during the night." And he goes on to say that at 9 o'clock, he's in a council meeting, and he had started a message to Brother Hancock. And then a Brother Earls comes in with a letter reiterating that five houses had been burned. The brethren on the west side of the creek had been obliged to leave and come on to the east side. Many were sick, and their goods were scattered about the cornfields. And that's it. That's all that's there for that day in the life of Brigham Young. So my question, if I could sit down and record an interview with him, were who were these five families? Who were the persecutors and why? I always had the impression that once Joseph Smith had been killed and it was made known that the saints were going to be moving west, that the persecution kind of stopped. But here we have, five families on the outskirts of Nauvoo being attacked. What did they do in Nauvoo to absorb these five families? I mean, this wasn't a time of great prosperity. What did Brigham Young and church leaders do to help these five families get back on their feet? And if my ancestors were one of these five families, I'd certainly love to know what their experiences were like. So sometimes the written word leaves a lot more questions than there are answers. And so I think by recording an interview, you can analyze more deeply and answer some of these questions.
Mel, what are some of the things you think we gained from a oral history versus written word?
Well, in the case of, pre-literate culture, whatever you can commit to writing is something that may never be available again. If the informant dies without passing the information on. And so I think this is probably the most important thing, is passing on or committing in a preservable, transmittable format information that is very, very perishable.
So you brought the page from Brigham Young's diary, and supposing that he is a person that you would like to actually have an oral history from, are there others?
Well, yeah, let's not count Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff,
okay.
All those. Let me get a little bit personal. I would love to interview a man named Richard K. Bridge, who was the missionary that baptized my great-grandmother in 1906 in Dresden, Germany, and that's where my church membership started. We actually have his journal over in the church archives, and one of my coworkers found it on eBay, bought it. It was cataloged, and I had no clue that it was there until a couple months ago when I was just running through the catalog and I found it. And he writes a very short description of the night that my great-grandmother was baptized. I'd love to know what it was like to teach that family, what their economic circumstances were. I'd love to interview that great-grandmother. I mean, I have personal interest in some of these people who left no written record, and I just have vague memories. So I think that would be great. I had the wonderful opportunity to interview my grandparents before they passed away, and those interviews are now treasured in my library. And we talked about what it was like to be a member of the church during World War I. They both experienced those wars, and what it was like to be Latter-day Saint immigrants in the 1920s. I have a lot of people I'd like to interview personally, not just figures in church history.
Exactly. Thank you. My dad would have turned 75 this past summer, and I was planning on doing some stuff, and it's too late because he died in April. And listening to you and your desires only makes me wistfully you know, think I could have done the same thing. So,
yeah. So is your mom alive?
She is gone as well. So it's a sad day for my oral history and family history.
Maybe I'll make a comment. When I, the summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I fell coming out of the barn and broke my arm. And and had to go. I went over and stayed with my grandparents who had come up to Idaho from Arizona. And I was recuperating there while my grandmother was taking dictation from my grandfather of his life story. And he was a great storyteller. Everybody loved to listen to his stories. He was, you know, one of the last of the cowboys, as it were, a real cowboy. And So I got to hear the unedited version of his life story, which would have been wonderful had it been recorded. Yeah. But at least she got it down, and she got it down, although it was not nearly as colorful as it was delivered. But still, the information is passed on, you know, in written form.
Yeah, and you know, you asked about what are some of the advantages to oral history. When I interviewed my two German grandparents, I got their accents and their speech patterns and their misuse of English nouns, because they would kick them to the end of the sentence like a German would. And all of that represents their personality, which is now gone. But I've got it on cassette tapes at home, and I can listen to that, and just brings back a flood of wonderful memories. So, I mean, you capture the essence of a person in the way that they speak, and some of the emotion that's there, and the spirit, too. I've been in interviews where somebody's bearing a testimony or talking about an experience that they've had, and the spirit is just pouring in, and you can feel that, and it's captured on tape. You can read it, but sometimes we speed read or skim or whatever, and the spirit's still there, you know, don't get me wrong, but I think it's there more powerfully when I'm re-experiencing that with the person's voice.
Good. Thank you. You talked briefly about the gatherings at Thanksgiving and the way that we Americans currently sort of do oral histories. If someone wants to do a formal oral history, what recommendations would you have? What would you think that they should cover, and how would they go about it?
Yeah. If I were to recommend sort of guidelines, formal guidelines, I'd say, number one, have a purpose for your oral history. And the purpose could be, my dad is 75 years old. He's not going to be around forever, and I want to capture his memories, his voice, his spirit, his personality. Number two, I would say, do your homework when you create the interview outline. I rarely go into an interview without some kind of outline. So I've done my homework. I kind of know who I'm talking to. I have some key dates and ideas in mind. So it's not just open-ended. I mean, there's advantages to open-ended because you get what you get. But if you have a purpose and you want to sort of guide the conversation, I do my homework and I have an interview outline. I try not to be restrictive in that. I ask open-ended questions and let the people run with the question and not just yes, no, or a single date. I make sure that I have good equipment and a quiet place. And these days, good equipment can be an $80 digital audio recorder. And Mel's actually the one who kind of turned me on to those. You started going digital before we did. Know how to use the equipment. Let the interviewee do most of the talking. Ask for specifics. Sometimes when you start an interview, people, they talk in generalities, and you get this encyclopedic information that is really not a reflection of their personality. And so I always try to ask for very specific things. And things like, questions like, how did you feel about that? When something happened, when an event happened, how did you feel? And questions like that. And just sit back and enjoy.
I'll just add a couple of things to what Matt has just said. I think that it's important to consider, or you have to be flexible on the equipment that you use. For example, some people don't want to be recorded. We often encounter that in villages where they don't want to be recorded, so we just end up writing down what they have to say. Some people don't. Videotaping would be a great way to go. So you can sit there and see your grandmother, your grandfather. Or in the case in Indonesia, in the island of Nias, where the people sing their genealogy. The memory device is in the rhyme and the meter of the genealogy. And in the delivery, the informant is jumping up and down and waving his arms around, and all of that would be, you know, a great thing to capture on videotape. But some people don't want to be videoed. They don't mind an audio recording, but they don't want to be videoed. And so you kind of have to use equipment according to what your informant is willing to tolerate. And another thing that I had an interesting experience with in our high priest group, just presenting something about family history and how and these different things that we've kind of been talking about today. And I introduced voice recognition software. And, you know, you can get it for free off the internet, or Windows operating system now has voice recognition software. And so for somebody, for older people who maybe just want to do this on their own, but they can't type, or they don't know how to type, or their fingers are swollen with arthritis and they can't really work at a keyboard, they can actually sit and talk into the computer and learn how to do how to do voice recognition type of recording. Our stake president, for example, he doesn't have those physical handicaps that I just mentioned, but he told me some months later that he was actually doing that to record his own life history. So there are many ways of doing this.
Yeah. I've had experiences where people have frozen up when I take out a tape recorder or an audio device. Or I did a little bit of videotaping where I had a videographer standing behind me. Sometimes people get really uptight and they can't think and they can't speak in complete sentences. And what I do in those situations is I ask some of the easy questions first, you know, set people at ease, build a relationship of trust. And after a while, people will loosen up. I only had one woman who stayed frozen the whole time during the interview. It was just an awful experience. It was the Stake Relief Society president in Harare, Zimbabwe, and she just could not speak to me with a microphone in front of the thing.
Well, you two have been very at ease in front of the microphones. Thank you today. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about oral histories, about oral histories in the church or in your experience?
I think you said the most profound thing about wishing that you had sat down with your father. I mean, there are academic reasons and historical reasons why my department gathers oral history, but I would hope that, any listeners or the members of the church in general would consider using oral history to capture some of these important family and personal memories that are so important to pass on in terms of a legacy or heritage to the next generation. I'm absolutely convinced of that. So I think you came up with the concluding remark.
Yeah, I second what Matt has said, that I think members of the church should be encouraged to do oral family history. I mean, you could perhaps even persuade your father, your grandmother, your aunt to sit down and say, look at a photo album and annotate the photographs into a recording. The software, we have software now where you can show that, you know, on the computer with the audio captions. And so there, you know, that's really, I think, to have, to hear family recollections in the voice of people that you knew and respected and loved would be a great treasure to pass on to your descendants.
Perfect. Thank you. We've been visiting today with Mel Thatcher of the Family History Department and Matt Heiss of the Church History Department, who both deal with oral histories and traditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here.